listening to Old New Borrowed Blue on 2SER with your host, Joel Kassam.
Hello and welcome to Old New Borrowed Blue on 2SER 107.3. Joel Kassam is my name. I hope you're doing very well and thank you for joining me this week. If you're new to the show, this is where I invite a special guest into the studio and they take the musical reins by playing four of their favourite songs. All right, let's find out who we've got this week. My guest today is a presenter, journalist, and an absolute huge music fan, whose media career has covered two decades and only seems to be getting better and better. After over 10 years of hosting mornings on Triple J, she's now jumped over to Double J, where she continues to keep us all entertained. It is the one and only Zan Rowe.
Welcome, Zan. Hi, Joel. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. I have to ask off the top, as someone who's used to doing interviews, is this weird for you being on the other side?
No, but it's not weird. It is nerve-wracking, though, and I do get an appreciation of how the other side feels because, you know, I love doing interviews, but it's also I hold all the power.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I know exactly what questions I'm going to be asking, so I don't know what you're going to ask, which is a bit scary, but I trust you, and I know that you won't throw me to the wolves, will you, Joel?
I'm going to try not to, yeah. Okay, so what got you into radio? Where did your love start?
It was community radio when my love of radio began, and I think that's this common story for a lot of people in radio, particularly at the ABC. I always wanted to communicate in some way. Like my whole life, I really wanted to be a writer. I was, you know, absolutely desperate to be a journalist. I wanted to get into journalism at RMIT. I then ended up doing a course, starting a course at Deakin University in Melbourne, doing professional writing, and that was kind of my dream job. And then I had a little bit of a kind of personal life upheaval where, you know, long story, this is a tangent, I won't go into it, but I basically went and lived in America for a couple of years. And right before that happened, I was hanging out with a friend of mine and it was a very fateful night where we were just, you know, kicking back at his place and he sort of looked at his watch at one stage and went, oh, I've got to go and do my radio show. And then sort of went, oh, do you want to come with me? And I said, oh, okay, I've got nothing to do because I was like, you know, just after high school, I had no job. I had nothing to do. I mean, I may have had a job, but it was a weird job that didn't keep normal hours. I had a lot of time on my hands. I was taking a year off between high school and going to university and I had a lot of free time. So I tagged along with him. He had a show at what was then called SRA, which is now SYN-FM in Melbourne. And I just sat in the room and watched him do this show with his friend and thought, oh, that looks fun. And then I went back the next week and then I went back the week after and then I decided to get on the mic with them and then I started to get involved with their test broadcasts. It was before they had a full-time license. So they'd be on air for like 3 months and then off air for another stack of months and they just did these test broadcasts before places like SYN-FM, FBI and a handful of other community stations got permanent full-time licenses back in the early noughties. That's the sort of period we're talking. And so while this was happening, I realized that I still loved writing, but my love for radio was kind of taking over. And I lived in America and then I'd come back to Australia for 6 months of the year and then go back to LA and live there. And every time I was in Australia, I'd do these test broadcasts. And then I became more involved with SYN-FM, with SRA. I became a part of the executive. I was there when they got their license. We wrote what the station would be. And then I just kind of went, oh, you know what? I think I want to change my degree. And I made a big decision. I went for a position at the media studies course, RMIT media studies course, which I managed to convince them to let me in as a mature age student because I was 21 by that stage. And I got into media studies at RMIT, majoring in radio and cinema. And then it just took off from there. But it wasn't like, oh, and then I got a job at Triple J. You know, I did years and years. Like I was working all kinds of crappy jobs. I was DJing at Revolver in Melbourne. I was DJing at the Corner Hotel after bands played and finishing off my uni degree, volunteering at Triple R, volunteering at SYN-FM, SRA, which was then SYN-FM, which it became, for 10 years before. So, sorry, yeah. If anybody wants to get into community radio, it doesn't necessarily take that long. But for me, it took 10 years of volunteering and working kind of crappy jobs before someone sort of said, hey, what do you think about doing some overnight shifts at Triple J?
Yeah. Cool.
So it was a long road and it wasn't a road that I necessarily was kind of like, when I grow up, I want to be a radio person, but I always wanted to be a communicator. I always wanted to share what I loved with people, whether that was through my writing or as it turned out through you know, making radio, which is where I ended up.
Lovely. I got to ask, did you have a DJ name?
No.
No? Just DJ Zanro?
Just DJ. I mean, I never called myself DJ Zanro.
Oh, okay.
I feel like you only call yourself a DJ if you actually like mix and stuff like that, which I never did. No, I never had a DJ name. I had some pretty funny community radio names. I remember we had a community radio show called Zap because it was me and my friend Paul, Zan and Paul, very clever.
Very, yes.
I called another one of my radio shows, it was a new releases show, and I called it Run with the Hunted, which was named after a Charles Bukowski book, which is such a university thing to do, to name your radio show after a Charles Bukowski book. But yeah, there was plenty of like cringeworthy radio names, but oh, I was always just Zan.
Okay. And so when did you start at Triple J?
I started at Triple J, I think it was 2005. I started doing overnight, so like part-time casual basis stuff in 2004, I think it was, while I was still working at Triple R, because I was doing a Monday drive show as a volunteer on Triple R, and then I was also working 2.5 days in the office as the talks producer, so I'd help organize all the interviews for the breakfast show and for all the non-music shows. And then at the same time, I was doing these overnight shifts, so I was in a million different headspaces in terms of waking and sleeping hours. And then I got, I was offered a job at Triple J in 2005 as the weekend lunch host, 10 till 2. And then also was asked to do other things like do interviews for Richard Kingsmill's new releases show, do live gig reports for Home and Hose, which was then hosted by Robbie Buck. So, yeah, I've been there for a long time. Wow. And then took over mornings as a mornings presenter in around 2006.
And you were there until last year,
yeah,
which is when you moved over to Double J. So that's like, I'm trying to do 13
12
years?
12 years, yeah. 12, yeah. Years? 12 years as mornings presenter and 13 years at Triple J, yeah.
Tell us about the move.
Well, I mean, God, it was daunting because it was something that I'd obviously been thinking about for a while in terms of, like anyone, you work in a certain job and I was doing the same show for 11, 12 years.
Yeah.
I was up for a new challenge. It was also really hard to leave a workplace that I loved so much, you know, and it was really emotional and I didn't know how, I guess, the public would react. And I was kind of like, is anyone going to care? You like start, not that it matters, like not that's the reason, but you sort of think, okay, what's the point of this? What am I overthinking it? Does it matter? Blah, blah, blah. And when I announced it, I was overwhelmed by the response and the family, because I think that sometimes, you know, when you work in radio, you put a lot of yourself out into the world and people will respond to you. But like most things, you know, you get a few bits in here and there, people just saying, oh, hey, I think this is great. But for the most part, people are going to react when they don't like something. So you really don't have any idea of how many people are out there. And it felt like a lot of people came out of the woodwork and it was just overwhelming and beautiful to finish up my time. And it was just time to jump into something new. I think that, you know, when I say that I left Triple J, I didn't really, because Double J and Triple J Unearthed and Triple J are all part of the same family. So I got the kind of best of both worlds where I get to step into a new challenge, work in different areas of the ABC as ABC National Music Correspondent, but then also I still am with my Triple J fam and hanging out with the same people and working with the same brilliant people. And for me, that's, you know, I sort of said goodbye to some of the audience at Triple J. I took a bunch of the audience with me who are ready to move to Double J with me. But I still get to see all the people that I physically see every day, all my workmates, which is just such a blessing because it is the best, for me, I'm very biased, but the best workplace in Australia. It's such a wonderful place.
You're on Old New Borrowed Blue here on 2SER. And my guest today is radio legend Zan Rowe. And she's choosing the music for us. So what's your old song and why have you chosen it?
I'm going back to the Beatles' White Album, which is, I'd have to say it's hard to pick, but I'd say my favourite Beatles album. And when I was thinking about a song to pick from this, it was so hard to pick one because it's really one of those records that makes the most sense when you listen to it from beginning to end. It's hard to isolate it. And it's easy to pick Blackbird because everybody loves Blackbird and it's such a special song. But I wanted to pick The Underdog because I feel like people make fun of Rocky Raccoon. I really feel like they make fun of Rocky Raccoon. And this is a song and an album that I just know every one of the words to. It's a record that was kind of introduced to me softly over the years. You know, it would be something that my parents played. It's something that the first person that I fell in love with gave me a cassette to, and I remember distinctly pressing play on my Walkman. That's how long ago it was, on the way home from that flight when I first had to leave him because he was in America and I was heading back to Melbourne, and pressing play on that and hearing Back in the USSR and listening to the whole record over and over again and just crying for the first 4 hours of that flight. But I love that. I love that melancholy that's filled. It's just, you know, it's like most great music, the music of the Beatles becomes this literally the soundtrack to our own lives. And Rocky Raccoon is just a great story, you know. Paul just writes stupid, great stories. He knows how to write a hit. So, yeah, this is why I picked this song.
Now, somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. And one day his woman ran off with another guy, hitting young Rocky in the eye. Rocky didn't like that. He said, I'm gonna get that boy. So one day he walked into town, booked himself a room in the local saloon. Rocky Raccoon checked into his room, only to find Gideon's Bible. Rocky had come equipped with a gun to shoot off the legs of his rival. His rival, it seems, had broken his dreams by stealing the girl of his fancy. Her name was McGill, and she called herself Lil, but everyone knew her as Nancy. Now she and her man, who called himself Dan, we're in the next room at the hoedown. A Rocky burst in and grinning a grin, he said, Danny boy, this is a showdown. But Daniel was hot, he drew fast and shot, and Rocky collapsed in the corner. Said, Rocky, you met your match. And Rocky said, Doc, it's only a scratch. And I'll be better, Doc, as soon as I am able. And now Rocky Raccoon, he fell back in his room, only to find Gideon's Bible. Gideon checked out, and he left it no doubt.
That was the Beatles there with Rocky Raccoon, taken from their 1968 self-titled album, also known as the White Album. My guest today is Zan Rowe. So when you left Triple J and moved to Double J, you brought with you Take Five, which is a show about, well, you get a special guest each week and they play five songs around a theme. I mean, that kind of sounds familiar to me, but I can't put my finger on why. Anyway, it doesn't matter. You've interviewed incredible guests. Do you still get nervous doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it depends on who it is, but I do get nervous if I know the artist, or because having worked in radio for so long, there's a lot of people that I've interviewed plenty of times and they're now kind of acquaintances. So
yeah,
those sort of people, I'm like, oh, it's great to see you again. But the artists that I get most nervous about, You know what? I get most nervous when I'm not prepared. So, for example, Paul McCartney, who I interviewed for the Take 5 towards the end of last year, that was incredible. That was, a lot of people say to me after that, you just didn't seem nervous. And I think there was part of me that was, I was absolutely nervous. I wanted to make it, and I felt a lot of pressure because I thought he's only doing a couple of interviews when he's in Australia. I've got the most amount of time with him. And this is a chance to really, for someone who's done thousands of interviews, how do I get something new out of this guy?
Yeah.
So I put a lot of pressure on myself. But before interviewing him, as soon as it was confirmed, I had my, you know, I was in the trenches and just researching. And that's what I do. And for me, if I have researched something to the nth degree and found ways to tell a story in the ways that I haven't seen in the 50 other interviews that I've researched, then I won't feel nervous because I know that whatever they say, and I'm sure that you feel this as well with Old New Borrowed Blue, it can go anywhere. These conversations can go anywhere. The best conversations that you hear as a listener and that I feel I do as a broadcaster are ones that I don't have any planning or control over, that I can do 5 pages of notes and then be ready if there's a flow to it and we're going down that corridor to throw them all out the window. And so, but I, to have that confidence with someone like Paul McCartney, who's had this huge decades-long career and so many different offshoots to it. The Beatles were only around for 8 years, but he did a million things after that.
Yeah.
And so I had to be able to follow him, whatever he said, and know what he was talking about. Didn't necessarily use that, but I could go down that road and down that rabbit hole with him, and that gave me confidence. So if I'm prepared, then I feel fine. I did, of course. I was kind of shitting myself when I met him. But he was actually, like, the thing that I've learned as well is that the people who are the biggest names, you know, and in my time in radio, I've interviewed personal heroes of mine, like David Byrne from Talking Heads, like PJ Harvey, like Beck, you know, Nile Rodgers, all these people whose music I've loved for years, all those people who are career artists, Paul included, are so nice because I think that the people who sustain long careers and work with a number of different people in their day-to-day life know that there's no benefit in being an asshole.
Yeah.
It's not good for them. It's not good for the people that they work with. And life is long and your career is long and it works out for better for everyone, and you also feel better in yourself if you're just kind to one another.
Yeah.
So I never get that big sense of bravado with those career artists. I often get that sense of kind of, you know, I don't know, just that weird a vibe that people put up where they're sort of trying to prove themselves, and that comes from much younger artists, and that's really off-putting, but never from more seasoned professionals, which is good because they're the kind of people that you'd be freaking out about.
Yeah, that's right. That's
but they're always the most chill.
Are you approaching it differently now that you're a double J?
I think I found that just given the demographic in which, you know, the audience we're talking to at Double J means that we're speaking to a slightly different, you know, there's different musicians that we're talking to, and those musicians will sometimes be a little bit older than maybe the, you know, 20-year-old musician I'm speaking to at Triple J. And as such, they've got more stories because they've lived a bigger life and they've had more experience, and they're usually more used to speaking on air. So the Take Fives, I'm now finding, I'm still preparing everything, but I'm kind of like, okay, I'm just going to ask like 3 questions, and then they're just going for it,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I'm finding it's just like there's more then I can fit into the Take Five with every one of them. And some of them, like, you know, did an Ice Cube Take Five a few weeks ago. That went for 1 hour and 18 minutes. That's the benefit of Double J. There's no news that you have to time out to. So we can go over 1 hour now. So the Take Fives are just going to get longer and longer. No, not really.
This is a 3-week episode.
Yeah, exactly. Strap yourself in. Part one.
The one you did with Ice Cube was, it was a live one at the Sydney Opera House. Was that your first live recording? How did you find that?
Really good, but I was nervous about how it would work because, you know, it's doing a live event and making it a radio, an intimate radio experience, are two very different outcomes.
Yeah.
I think that with him, it was a great success because he was so compelling. He'd never done anything like that before, which blew my mind, but no one ever asked him to do an in conversation.
That is insane.
Yeah. And he's got stories.
Yeah, exactly.
But he, I asked him questions that weren't, that didn't make him want to answer in sound bites, because Ice Cube is an incredible artist but also an incredibly successful self-promoter. Whatever he's working on, whether it's a movie or his 3-on-3 basketball league or something else he's promoting, he knows how to just like bring the hype, you know, punch it out. And I didn't go near any of that stuff or click in his muscle memory where he'd start doing that. And that's so basically what I did after, you know, it took about 15 minutes, but I peeled back those defenses. And I got a vulnerable side of Ice Cube that I'd never seen before, And it was a great compliment to me the next day when Hal Latukefu, who does the hip-hop show on Triple J and does Sky High on Double J, and is such a hip-hop head, knows everything about, has read all the interviews, has heard everything that these artists have to say, and he came into the studio next day and said, I've never heard him tell those stories before. And that was just like, oh my God, that's so good. I'm so happy. But it's just the nature, again, you'd know this through Old New Borrowed Blue, when people are talking about music, there's something, there's a vulnerability that comes out, you know, you sort of, you set aside that front that you're trying to put up or the way that you think people see you, and you're talking about stuff that connects deeply to you, whether it's something that's affected you as a little kid, whether it's a moment that soundtracked a moment in your life where something really awful happened or something really beautiful, it just pulls back that front and shows, you know, the soft underbelly of who you are. And that's why I love it so much. It's just so special to me. So I was really happy that I could bring the Take 5 to Double J, and the artists that we've had in this year alone, amazing conversations with Kamasi Washington, with Angel Olsen, with Beck, you know, with Ice Cube. It's just, it's such a rich, fun exploration into people's musical hearts. So I hope I'm doing it till I die, to be honest. Like, I love it. I love it so much.
All right, Zen, it's time for you to tell us about your new song.
Oh, man, I love this album so much, and I wanted to share a song from it. But again, it's, you know, like the White Album, it's kind of a song that you kind of need to listen to the whole record in full. John Hopkins is the artist. He's a UK producer. He hasn't released anything in about 5 years. Really heavily influenced by Brian Eno, who's another artist that I really love. And he, on this album Singularity, he kind of starts off with beats and it's almost like you're in a rave, and then he gets into this atmospheric minimalism meditation, and that's what it feels like. This song, Feel First Life, is to me, I've listened to this record constantly on loop, and it feels like a meditation to me. And it's, you know, the first 6 months of this year, for a number of reasons, personally and professionally, were really tough for me. And I turned to music as a salve, you know, and this song was just such a salve. Like every time I needed just a breather, a mental breather and some healing. I know that sounds totally hippie, but it did it for me. It's such a beautiful song. But I encourage anybody who likes this just to listen to the whole record in full. It's meant to be listened to as a complete package. And I always pay attention to what artists tell me what to do. Thank you.
the ambient sounds of John Hopkins there off the album Singularity. That was Feel First Life. Now, Zen, you, of course, sat opposite Dr. Carl for many years. How was that?
Amazing.
Yes.
I mean, you know, he's a nutter.
Yeah.
But also one of the things that people don't necessarily know about Carl is that he's one of the most busy but generous people I've ever met. So he has no time in the world, but whatever time he has it for you.
Yeah.
He's the longest serving segment on Triple J is his science segment. And that was something that I came into as custodian of the morning show all those years ago. And he was there because the old morning show years ago used to be like a magazine format show where you'd have stories that appear on Hack on the morning show. There'd be interviews and it'd be kind of almost like a variety show, yeah. Magazine format show between 9 and midday. And then that sort of shifted around and all those stories got taken out and crunched down into Hack every weekday at 5:30. But Dr. Carl remained, and he has remained for 30 years, 35 years,
yeah.
Maybe even longer. And so, you know, stepping into that, and he's someone who's very flexible and he sort of rolls with the punches. He's always Carl, no matter who comes and goes. But we really formed and forged a very strong relationship. And I just had so much fun with him every week. Like I said, like, you never know what he's going to say, and usually it's going to be outrageous. It's very entertaining. And it's so wild that's, you know, there's not wild, it's actually really brilliant. It's someone who is talking about science, about the magic of the world around us and stuff that sometimes is relegated to nerdy kind of people in the corner, you know, sort of, you know, they're into science and technology. No, this is actually the coolest thing. Like, Dr. Carl makes science cool.
Yeah.
And there's obviously such a curiosity for understanding how the world works, and the world is science. So being able to explore that with him every week, you know, I learned so much, but also become his friend. He's someone that I would go to dinner at his place and hang out with. He gave me so much advice, you know, about life and certain things, and was always there for me, and is just such a beautiful man. But yeah, I think that he'll probably be there, you know. He's obviously still continued doing the Science Hour with Linda Mariano, the new host. Whoever is the host after Linda, he'll still be there. Dr. Carl, you know, he's been there since the dawn of time.
Yeah.
But he's just such a wonderful guy and truly, you know, a beautiful man and a great friend. Always curious, always excited, always positive. Like, I'm just, you know, one of the best people around.
I had him on the show last year, actually, and I asked
him. Did you get that sense from him?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. He's very, he wouldn't stop. He's just go, 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 you know what I mean?
You can't say something to him. This is what I learned. You can never say to him, I said to him a couple of times before we went on air, all right, Carl, like, it was maybe something that we could, you know, had to steer away from politically that was not necessarily science-based. I'm like, make sure that you do blah, blah, blah. And then as soon as I would open up the mics, he'd be like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I realized that whatever you say to him, it's just in the frontal lobe. There's no filter, for better or worse. But yeah, he's very excited about life, Dr. Carl.
Yes. I asked him if he had any questions that he remembered that really stood out. Do you have any from that time that you can remember?
Oh, God, you're putting me on the spot. I'm just thinking of all the wrong ones.
Yeah. I mean, that's what his was. that's what happened. It doesn't matter if you don't want to talk about it.
I'm just thinking. So many. You know when you're asked a question, then your mind just goes completely blank?
That's me every day. All right, we'll talk about music. It's obviously such a huge passion of yours. Why do you think that is? Why do you think music is so important to us?
Well, you know, music is emotion. It's for me, it's a sensory connection. So when I hear songs, I have a gut feeling, or I feel the need to tap my foot or twitch my arm, or it takes me back to a memory in my life. Music is so, so important to my emotional intelligence, and always has been. And I think that's partially because I grew up in a house full of music. I didn't have particularly, you know, musical family. Like, my mum and my brother played piano, or both my brothers played piano. My dad didn't really play any instruments. I dabbled, but I could never read music. So I became more of a critic than someone who could actually do music myself, which is very convenient. I just critique everyone else's abilities. But it was always part of our life. And I think the importance of music and the messages in music too, the kind of music that my parents would play, there was more than just, it wasn't just kind of the top 40 stuff. Like, they, you know, we had a big vinyl collection and we'd listen to records in full, and you'd really get an understanding of the story that was trying to be told from these artists that they loved. And my parents took me to concerts when I was little. Like, music was really part of my life from a very young age. So maybe that's it. But I think that I've always loved the discovery, as much as I love the, you know, the memories of the old, I love the discovery of the new and that kind of hunger of finding something that is completely different to anything that I'd heard before or anything I thought I liked and being just shaken. Yeah. I love that. Mm. I still love that. Like, oh, that's weird. I never thought I'd like this. This is exciting. And I think that that's just a general curiosity about, you know, knowing the things that weren't known before. Not that I want to be a know-it-all, but just understanding something that's something bigger than just the stuff that's sort of drip-fed through commercial radio or whatever. And, you know, I was a big listener to community radio and to Triple J as a kid as well. And the sort of scope of what is shared in that realm compared to the very narrow playlists that commercial or oldies radio. I do love oldies radio though. I'm partial to a bit of a WSFM Saturday night or a smooth FM Sunday afternoon. But the knowledge that there is so much to explore in the world and we're barely scratching the surface. There's always more. It's exciting.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Well, you do have quite a bit of knowledge. You do like a correspondent thing on ABC talking about music.
Yeah. Well, I'm the ABC's official ABC national music correspondent, which is quite a mouthful. But for years and years, I've been doing a spot on ABC News Breakfast on Wednesday mornings at 7:45, where I just talk about the week's music news. And that's been really fun, you know, to, I guess, talk to a different audience about things and, you know, cover the fun stuff. Like last week I talked about Belinda Carlisle touring, but then I can also talk about why it's, you know, people are annoyed that Drake takes over Spotify. Like we get, you know, and then also things about like separating the art from the artist when Chuck Berry dies and everyone's talking about what a great rock and roller he is. But it's like, you know, but he also was abusive to women in this way. So I like having the opportunity to, you know, talk about a greater musical history as well as just talking about what tours are announced. All of that stuff, I think music is such a big conversation. And like all art, it's not just an indulgence or a luxury. It kind of is, but it's also like it's telling the stories of our time. Any good art is talking back to the culture and not only responding to what's happening politically and socially and humanly, but it's making a record of that. And you hear that in all the art through music that we've heard through the decades. It's a capture of a time. And I think that, you know, for that reason and so many more reasons, that's why I value it, because it's more than just, you know, dancing on a Saturday night at your friend's place. It's like it's a bigger story and it's a beautiful story and it's an entertaining story, but it's, you know, it's doing a lot of things at the same time.
I wanted to ask, because you're doing this on TV, obviously, and you're quite well known for radio. Do you have a preference?
Why can't we have both?
Yeah.
I like the challenge of doing television because it's something that I'm comfortable with it now, but when I started it, I didn't know it as well. I think I like the intimacy of radio. You know, I really love exploring new TV stuff. But if I'm to be honest, last year when I was thinking, what do I do after Triple J, there was a period where I was thinking about doing something completely different. And this year doing radio still with Double J, I'm so thankful that I kept doing that because I truly love the connection that you have with an audience with radio. It's such an intimate connection. When people come up to me and say, I feel like you're my friend, that is the best feeling in the world, because it means that, you know, the passion that I feel and the way that I am excited about something that I want to share with the listener, i.e. like I want to share with my friend, that's being felt on the other side. It's not just a one-way communication. So yeah, I just think that radio has, you know, it's one of the oldest forms of communication. There's always talk about TV killing radio, video killing radio, Spotify killing radio. It never will, because people want to be, for all those reasons, they want to be surprised. They want to go outside of the algorithm and find, you know, be told about something that they never would have discovered had it not been for someone going, hey, look over here. And algorithms can't do that. And automated systems can't do that. So yeah, I've still got such a passion for radio and for community radio too. You know, like I was born and raised on community radio. I still listen to a lot of community radio, and that has been the foundation of my music passion. So I think that, you know, stations like 2SER, like Triple R, like FBI, like Sin FM, you know, like RTR, Triple Z are just, you know, such a foundation in the community. And also just for listeners who don't necessarily have a buy-in, whether they're in a band or in an arts organisation, it's just such a relationship with listeners. It's really special. I get very emotional about it.
No, I mean, I might be slightly biased, but I totally agree with you. You're right.
We're lucky. We're really lucky.
We are. It's time for you to play your Borrow song now. Can you tell us about it?
Well, this ties in, I guess, to the conversation I was just having about my parents and being, you know, great recommenders. They were huge Midnight Oil fans, and my parents are both very much social activists. We used to go to a lot of rallies when I was a little kid. I remember walking down the streets of Melbourne with signs that said, "I'd rather grow than glow," in anti-nuclear disarmament, sort of, you know. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't say anti-nuclear disarmament, anti-nuclear rallies. Definitely wanted disarmament. Definitely wanted uranium. I remember uranium, no thanks, was another great slogan. Very polite. Uranium, no thanks. But they were massive Midnight Oil fans, and the Oils were the first concert I ever went and saw when I was 9 years old. It was off the back of this record coming out in 1987, and watching Peter Garrett and the Oils on stage was just such a life-changing moment for me, both in the performance, in their politics, in the power of what they were doing, and all of the players, like Rob Hurst strumming, just so furious. Peter Garrett, obviously an incredible frontman. Jim Magini, just watching them, I was like, what the hell? I still get shivers, and I can still picture that stage with the big water tank on it and Rob playing the water tank like a drum and just this amazing concert. And as a nine-year-old kid watching that, it just set me up for life, you know? It's like, I want more of this. It was so exciting. But still to this day, whenever I hear the Oils and having seen them when they reformed last year, they still just, they have all that power and they still send shivers down my spine, and their music is timeless, and it's still, you know, for better or worse, the lyrics ring true today. So yeah, very special band to me.
Yeah.
off the album Diesel and Dust. That was the unmistakable sounds of Midnight Oil with The Dead Heart. So, Zen, how are you finding wrapping up the week with Miff Warhurst on Bang On?
Oh, I love it. So fun. I've been friends with Miff for so long. And since I started working, just before I started working at Triple J, because we sort of used to cross paths in Melbourne all the time. And she is... I think she could be a stand-up comedian. Like, she's that good. She's one of those people who, no matter what I throw at her, she just has these wonderful zingers. But she's we came up with that idea for Bang On literally after a few white wines on a plane on the way back from Canberra. And just we were both doing different things. I was at Triple J. She was doing Double J lunch at the time. And we're like, well, I want to do something different. Let's just... I'm sick of reading all these think pieces from this and blah, blah, blah. Let's just, you know, let's do a podcast. Let's have this idea. So we kind of, you know, we're a little bit pissed and then followed through, which is a rare occasion.
Yeah.
And it's just been a joy. And I think the thing with Bang On as well is that we have a great time and get to sort of talk about the stuff that we don't necessarily have space to in our own shows because we're by ourselves. And now even that she's doing a show on ABC Local, we're still by ourselves, so you can't really bounce off yourself. You can't have a conversation with yourself, but together we get to kind of dissect the week. And the response from people listening and joining us has been, again, so overwhelming. We call them our Bang Fam. We have lots of other iterations on Bang Gangs and all kinds of stuff, which is, you know, so wrong it's right. But it's been great, like so much fun. And yeah, we did a live event in Sydney last year, planning on doing more live events in Melbourne and Sydney this year. So yeah,
excellent.
It's been really fun and really silly. But yeah, it's a very fun podcast. You can be part of the Bang Fam too. Just search Bang On wherever you get your podcasts. Sneaky little plug. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. And you know, there's in this day of think pieces and so much water cooler discussion, for lack of a better word, it's kind of nice to provide a little shortcut to that. If everyone like, how do you make sense of the world? Here are all the stupid things that have been happening on the internet.
Yeah.
Like Big Dick Energy a couple of weeks ago, that was such a gift. I came back like, I'd been off for 3 weeks, I'd been overseas, and the week that I came back to Bang On, I was like, right, Big Dick Energy, that's what we're talking about. Just the stupidness of the internet every week. So it's very fun.
Okay, you've got Mornings, Take Five, Bang On, ABC correspondent. How do you find time to listen to new music?
Good question. I am listening a lot in the times that I'm not on air. I've got the headphones on all the time. I'm often listening, you know, at home when I'm hanging out, doing the washing, making dinner, just constantly listening to music. But the reality is that there's more music produced than there is minutes in the day for me to be able to listen to it. So I'm often chatting with friends who I trust and we're sharing stuff that we really like. And I'm trying to get around to all the things that people send me, but sometimes I can't. That's kind of the blessing and the curse of the way that music is made and distributed now. You sort of, you know, you get rid of the traditional gatekeepers. You get to make music yourself and produce it.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait for a label to say, oh, we think it's good enough to release. You get to, you know, distribute it yourself or upload it to Unearthed or, you know, email me and say, hey, there's this, you know, here's a song that I've made. But that means that the volume of stuff being made is huge. So it does get a bit overwhelming, but I think it's good for art ultimately that there's, you know, the plurality of ways of getting your stuff out there. And I think that the other thing that I've really been noticing as well in terms of the way things are written about, and even this relates to Triple J and the greater Triple J family, is that that idea of, you know, you have to get playlisted on Triple J or you need to have your music, you know, celebrated or recommended in, you know, on that streaming service or whatever, it doesn't necessarily exist as much. There's so, with the plurality of distribution, there's all these communities that pop up. There's people recommending in, you know, comment threads. And of course, recommendation is one of the hugest, I think, motivators for me, just as I take recommendations from a friend way more than I would someone who I don't know emailing me.
Yeah.
Friends will listen to their friends more than they'll, you know,
yep,
take the advice of someone that they don't know. So there's so many different ways for us to discover music. And so for as a broadcaster, but also as a music fan, I think it's good. It's big, but it's good.
Yeah.
But there's lots of different communities that get to celebrate music. And there's plenty of artists who tour Australia or play shows in the capital cities and even in the regions that haven't been playlisted on Triple J or haven't been, you know, supported and other traditional methods that are finding their own audiences, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What about finding time for yourself then?
That's so glad you asked me that. I'm actually in the middle of having a bit of a work-life balance thing at the moment.
Good.
Because, well, you know, one of the benefits of my job is that I get to do a lot of the things that I love for work, but then it also means that a lot of the things that I love, I have a crossover with work. So I'm trying to find more time to separate those things. I went for a great hike over the weekend.
Excellent.
Which was nice. There was no soundtrack involved.
Okay.
Just the sound of the wind through the trees. I was thinking about joining a 10-pin bowling league to do something completely unrelated to my work. But yeah, the work-life stuff is always a bit of a tricky balance. But again, I feel very privileged that that's my main problem, that I kind of can't separate the two because, you know, some people don't get to do what they love for a living, so I'm a pretty lucky kid.
You mentioned 10-pin bowling there. Did I read that you once played dodgeball?
Yes. I had a dodgeball team called Dodger Federer, which was very fun. And can I tell you that pinning soft balls against one another on a Wednesday night in Marrickville is highly recommended.
It's really good.
I
mean, this is the thing. I play as well.
Oh, really?
But I play on trampolines.
Oh, my God. That's even better.
Different sort of, yeah. A lot more injuries.
I was going to say, that's like you're supposed to be looking at where you're throwing the ball, but also where you're landing.
Yeah, I can see
where there'd be a lot. That sounds dangerous.
Ankles, yeah.
Oh, God. No, but also, I'm kind of keen to try that out. That sounds amazing.
I'll tell you where to go and come down and have a game. What's next for you, Zan? Do you have plans for the future?
Oh, for me personally?
Yeah.
Always have plans. I definitely am keen to do more TV things just because I love the challenge. Maybe write a book?
Yeah.
Where do I find the time for that? Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm a writer. That's
the
thing.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to ask if you wanted to get back into writing.
Yeah, I've still continued to write. I have done bits and pieces. I used to contribute quite a lot to Triple J magazine, and I've done a couple of commissioned pieces for a couple of books, different little collections of writings. But, yeah, maybe it's time for me to write my own book. Very scary when I say that out loud. We'll see.
I think you should definitely consider it.
We'll see.
Zanro, if the music and interviews have been the soundtrack to our lives the past decade or so, you have without doubt been the perfect narrator. Thank you so much for coming in to All New Borrow Blue and
hanging
out with me.
Thank you so much for having me, Joel. Music.
You're welcome. Please take us out with your blue song.
Blue song. Okay, this is another new one. And it's hard to pick a blue song because I didn't want to make it too much of a downer. So I thought I'd pick something that is my favourite type of genre, which is the breakup song, but the breakup song with hope. And this is an artist who I just recently discovered over the last year or so, but I love. Her name is Nao. She hails from South London and she's doing what a lot of great artists are doing at the moment, which is having this kind of classic R&B sound, but with her own twist on it. And this song I love because it is an end of a relationship, but there's a sense of hope in that maybe now's not the right time, but that doesn't mean the end of the story. I think that, like, as I get older, across my whole life, and I've had breakups in love and jobs and friendships, I think that when you're young, you have this very linear idea of the way things go. You know, it's great and start and then drama and then end and then next. And as I get older, I realize that it doesn't always happen that way, that there's tangents and that sometimes you come back to something and it's better the second time around. Or it's different, but it's a new story. And I love that this song tells that kind of story. And she's just got such a great voice. So, yeah, I love this song by Nao.
Thank you, Zan.
Thanks, Joel.
I hope you find your way. Sorry we couldn't make it. Still, I miss you anyway. Yeah, I just grew and couldn't break it. How I wish perfect was enough for my own heart. Sometimes I swear it was enough for my own heart. I guess I'll wait another lifetime. know how to make mistakes. Wasn't grown enough to fake them. Everybody makes mistakes. Do we live and learn to brave them? How I wish I was good enough for our own heart. Don't ever think you weren't enough for our own heart. I guess I'll wait another lifetime. Oh, ooh-hoo. Me to sing another lifetime. Meet me in another lifetime.